This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Oh, welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's disturbing, new,
frustrating,
long overdue in the world of books and reading. Today it is, at least. Sometimes it is. The show title last week was The Rolling Reckoning, and I see you've taken on that jargon and to do some follow-up. So maybe that's our Rolling Reckoning. So we have a new segment here. We do Heroes of the Week, Turkeys of the Week, May Your Efforts Succeed and Fail, but maybe there's this section that's the Rolling Reckoning, because a lot of it's coming and continue to come here. Let's see. Today is Thursday, April 29th, 2022. I'm Jeff O'Neill. She's Rebecca Shinsky. We're coming to you from BookRiot.com. It is mostly a follow-up week about big stories we talked about last week over the Blake Bailey biography, and then Simon & Schuster's publishing's mess that Simon & Schuster's the tip of the arrow of. It's coming for everyone. This question about what kinds of books, what publishers are going to publish into the future is not going away. There's a very good piece Ron Charles wrote in the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. Props to Uncle Ronnie over there. Who I haven't read in a while, and he can have his own thing. But I think that Ron Charles is saying what he says is indicative of something.
Yes.
It's not just us, right, Rebecca?
It's not just people our age. I have some notes about that. I think it's a meaningful shift, expansion of this movement and of these questions. Mm-hmm. That it's not just millennials with podcasts and Gen Zers on Twitter or wherever Gen Zers go to talk about these issues. It's members of the establishment, and it doesn't get much more capital E establishment than the head of the Washington Post book section.
I was trying to think, now that Kakutani is writing picture books with Bette Midler, I guess is what she's doing in her whatever post role. It's like Dwight Garner, Janet Maslin, Ron Charles. What I'm saying is there is no hang a lantern on it reviewer kind of person.
Right. Anymore. Yeah.
I think that position's
there
taken.
Could be a big piece in the New York Times book section, but Pamela Paul's name is not is not a name in book reviewing to, I think, the general reading public the way that, Kakutani and Janet Maslin and Ron Charles are.
We talk a lot about celebrity book clubs, but I think that's the spot that celebrity book clubs blew up as much as anything.
Yes.
Is like the traditional book reviewer, starred review, X gave it a name. Like, you just don't see that. It just doesn't matter.
I think you're right. It was book curation for boomers and beyond, and that has shifted from being, traditional media, the book reviewers in traditional media, to being celebrities and sort of more mainstreamy pop culture touching sorts of things. Yeah.
Which is probably, I don't know if it's good or bad. It's certainly more democratic's not the right word. I'm looking populist of a way of thinking about it. Anyway, we'll get to that in a minute. And I guess the other thing I say is it's not that since Ron Charles is now on the train, it doesn't validate the existence of the train.
Right.
Just the amount of steam the train has. He's on board. Anyway, we'll get to that.
We can talk about that in a minute.
Thank you for all your moms, dads, grads. We are not closed to recommendation requests. I'm not sure we're going to get to all of them, but thank you so much for writing in. We're going to record that next week. You've already done some notes, it looks like. I saw you out there mining our Slack channel for ideas. I saw that.
Well, I have a nose for when there's a question that neither of us is qualified to answer.
So, that's almost like after 500 episodes, we know what we can talk about.
Right. I called on our contributors for ideas about some of the ones that I was like, I could Google my way to an acceptable answer, or I could ask people who really know about this. So I asked them and there's a really nice variety of questions this time around. I don't think I ran into any where I think we're going to have to fight over who's going to get to recommend one of our shared favorites. So that's
no
fun
RSTLNEs in there.
I don't think so. There's okay. one that might be a little ripe for a Tiny Beautiful Things recommendation, but like, come on, everybody needs Tiny Beautiful Things.
It's a really good point. It's like I was just Amanda and I were DMing about the Shadow and Bone series. We both finished that. And I was thinking about if we should do a segment or a special episode or something. And it reminded me of, I think it was our old Book Nerd Movie Club kind of shtick, which is like, are we sure Zendaya shouldn't be in this? Like, are we sure this isn't the Tiny Beautiful Things or Gilead reference? Right. Are we sure this is not Colson Whitehead? Or are we sure we're not going back to the well?
Proceed directly to Tiny Beautiful Things for That's basically right. any question about life.
Just read it, and then it's available to you to recommend, and it can be your Swiss Army recommendation
That's
from
true.
Here on out. Anyway, let's do our first sponsor break, and we'll come back and do the actual follow-up rather than the preview of the follow-up we're going to do. It'll be the real follow-up this time.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have seven great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love. But the thing is, she's number six. So if he is to have seven great loves, does that mean his time with Irena is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first-generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to portray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
In Rebecca's idiosyncratic interest department, the following the course of Murakami's t-shirt line from announcement to release, I would have lost a bet on this one. I have to say, I'm delighted, but I would have lost a bet that this would have made it to an agenda twice. Not once,
yeah,
but twice.
You know, this is just serendipitous timing, because Amanda just shared the link to the live t-shirt collection. It's on Uniqlo in the contributor Slack. And I was like, oh yeah, we talked about that on the podcast. And I think you would have been on the right side of the bet, really, because I don't really personally care about Murakami's t-shirt line. Like, I'm not a big Murakami fan. I'm not an unfan. He just has never particularly rung my bells in a way that made me go back. And so I'm not, you know, the customer for the Murakami t-shirt line.
You're more
line.
Like a Murakami fan. Kind of there.
There's a show title candidate right there.
There it is, right.
And I wasn't like waiting for this to happen. You know, I didn't have a Google alert for Murakami t-shirt line, but it appeared. I was like, oh, we talked about the fact that that was coming. I'm sure we have some listeners who do want a Murakami t-shirt. They're only $14.90, which that is a very reasonable price point, as Uniqlo is good for doing. And of course, one of them has a cat on it. And it's like a disgruntled cat looking, sitting at a desk that says Murakami Radio. The whole like line is named Murakami Radio. So if you're into this, there's a little variety of t-shirts you can check out. I would love to know if any of our listeners are going to be rocking a Murakami Radio t-shirt. I'm just delighted that on the list of like very serious novelists who would end up with a t-shirt line, I would have lost the bets that Murakami would have been one of them. He would have been like a millionth on my list of who's going to do
that. I'm really not surprised. He's a pop culture fan. He's an interesting, strange guy. But yeah, it's... And the t-shirts are as sort of understated and inscrutable as you might expect. Yep. You know, it's like, I don't know what these refer to. I might wear the Murakami Radio one that has a big vinyl LP in the middle because that's kind of weird. One is just the Norwegian wood in regular, you know, almost like a Garamond capitals. And then Haruki Murakami, it's not the cover. Mm-hmm. It's not by. It's just very. And another one's a bird. I guess, you know, you're supposed to know it's a wind-up bird chronicle reference there because that. No, I'm sorry. Kafka on the Shore is the reference there, but it's very small. Like, I don't know. This is for those of you who for whom Wes Anderson is a little too, not twee enough.
Yeah, there's one that has a half moon on it, and then says, right. "Don't let appearances fool you," but in mirror writing.
Yeah, it's backward. Not backwards. It's in mirror writing. That's right, and that's from Q1884 as a reference to that.
So,
all right,
you know,
some of them are low on stock. The low on stock ones are the Kafka on the Shore one. I'm not surprised the Murakami Radio with the cat seems to be the most in demand.
If you were going to pick an iconic, if you were going to guess at an iconic Murakami situation, it's a cat for sure.
Yeah, eating food and playing jazz. Right. So that'd be sort of the thing there. Okay, so no free ads.
A cat eating food and playing jazz. Are we just talking about Garfield?
Yeah, I guess, that's right. Mondays, right? I guess these are... I guess let's start with the Amazon one because it's a little bit quicker. 500,000 workers are getting raises from Amazon, ranging from 50 cents an hour to $3 an hour. I don't think we talked on this show. It came out between our discussion of the Amazon union effort in Alabama being voted down, and then Bezos' last letter as CEO of Amazon, where he explicitly talked about needing to do better for their workers, which is, I guess if you have, what, $1 trillion company and you've got some more, that's quite a flex to be like, on my last one, now we're, now Amazon needs to, okay, Jeff. All right, easy partner. So how much of that is response to the union? How much it is something that is maybe not directly related to the union, but related to growing calls for Amazon's accountability and monopoly talk against tech companies, against Amazon in particular? How much of it might be genuinely wanting to do better? Throw it all into a basket, but the timing is too strange to discount completely. That the unionization effort. And this is one of the reasons why unions, even if they don't win, the effort matters, right? I think that's another thing that's underappreciate sometimes, is a failed effort can still win things for workers in that matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a fired Amazon worker attempting to unionize other warehouse employees outside of Alabama. I haven't gotten into the details of that piece, but it's linked in this Verge piece, and I think you're exactly right. Like, we won't know ever really what Bezos's or Amazon's real motivation for this is, other than I think it's fair to assume now that they also can see that a reckoning is coming or has begun. There's been a real shift in the way that the public understands and talks about Amazon. And even folks who are still very frequent Amazon customers, even just like in my personal circle, talk about it regrettably, you know, like, oh, I wish I could get myself away from Amazon. Yeah, right. It's not like nobody's like stoked about being reliant upon Amazon as a customer. And that recognition that maybe you're feeding into or taking advantage of a system that is unfair and treats people poorly in many situations. So I'm glad to see raises for whatever reason. Like, ideally, it's for altruistic humanitarian reasons of we treat people fairly and we pay them for their work and we want to create good working conditions. But even if it's just because he wants to avoid additional future bigger
even
problems.
Even if it's just strategic, that's still good.
Right. It's still good. Better. The net result is still an improvement. Yeah. And I hope that Amazon workers continue to attempt to unionize and organize for as long as it takes to push Amazon into the position of having good pay and good working conditions for everyone. And maybe they can get there without unionizing. Mm-hmm. I think that's what Amazon would like, is to not have to deal with unions, but it's going to take more than this. And there's just no way that this timing is an accident.
I, you know, if we could go to the court of truth, that's adjacent to the court of rightness, where you could just find out what's the truth versus what's right. I would be surprised if it's not a meaningful piece of the pie of that decision too. This reminds me, I had a little birdie conversation this week.
Oh, I love a birdie conversation.
And this was, it was about Amazon, but insofar as it was about Audible though. And we were talking about audiobook consumption over the last several years. And I asked someone in a position to know in the industry, or at least have some data. I said, is my sense that Audible is, you know, it's still the dominant player in audiobooks, retail audiobooks. But is it, am I right that it's slipping? Am I right that it's not, it's still the 800 pound gorilla, but it was the zoo, right? And now it's just one. And they're like, yeah, actually, again, it's still the major player. But these, you know, Libro, Apple's really picking up, apparently. Mm-hmm. Like, this is something I haven't seen covered. Now, this could just be, this is for this one birdie's tree, you know, that they're seeing particularly. But it's a big enough tree that I think it is indicative of the forest to some degree. And I don't know. And I think I've expressed on the show myself, I've unsubscribed from Audible. And it's not really an anti-Amazon thing, though I sort of get that moral thing for free. I just don't want the subscription. You know, we've talked about this a million years. Treat me like an adult. Tell me what the price of the audiobook is. Let me buy it as a one-off, and I can go listen to it. Is that so? Like, this stuff where you go on Amazon, and you're like, I want to see the audiobook of, I don't know. I was just looking at the new Malcolm Gladwell, The Bomber Mafia, which, say what you will about Gladwell, World War II bomber stuff, it's like, I can't, I have to look at it. It's like, man. I don't know. I mean,
a Gladwell World War II book is like the daddest of dad.
Yeah,
books.
It's not very long. And I was like, how much is it? And I'm like, I want to buy it as a one-off for audio. Cause also the Gladwell thing over there at Pushkin Industries, which is his company. He's one of the owners or founders, or I'm not exactly sure, but a big mocker over there at the company, is these highly produced audiobooks that are more like audio documentaries than the audiobooks. So I'm like, all right, audio is the way to do it. And I go on Audible, and it's like free with your Audible subscription. It's like, I have to click through the thing, and it's like $1,000. But I go over to Apple, it's like $14.99, one off. I mean, it's still expensive, but at least I can do it. And I do wonder if there's a couple different things here where Audible has a dominant position and a dominant business model that's extremely lucrative. And there might be a bit of an innovator's dilemma situation going on, to quote the Clay Christensen thing of like, there's some disruption from below, or at least other competitors doing something different. And Audible's business model has been so lucrative and their position so dominant that they are loath, of course, to change it, which then reinforces the cycle of competition and so on. So I'm interested to watch that. But I felt vindicated, validated, otherwise V-word about, you know, my sense that I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one. And people I'm talking about, the ones like, I want to Audible, but I want to do Audible. Just for all the things that we're talking about, too. And there's actually a UX experience there, too. And for all of Amazon's talk, and I think in a lot of ways, it's not just talk, it is true, is that a lot of what they do is focused on the customer having a great experience. Sometimes that's at the expense of the worker or the retail. You know, like, but in this particular case, it doesn't. This is not in the user's best interest.
Right.
Like, this just isn't. So I wonder how long it will be. So that there you go. That little something. I brought you a little something. Just
I appreciate
it. So yeah, there's that, I guess. Speaking of your employee, your workforce coming to the front, right? We saw Simon & Schuster, this open letter to Simon & Schuster from its workforce. We got some count. There was 3,500 signatures from people outside Simon & Schuster and about 300 from people inside Simon & Schuster. I didn't look. Did you happen to see, what is Simon & Schuster, like, what kind of matriculation rate are we talking about here?
Oh, I did not look. Yeah, I intended to, and I didn't. Yeah. But I would guess, I think there's a couple thousand folks in Simon & Schuster. There have to be.
Right? Would you, I didn't really have a number in mind. I hadn't thought about this. Let's go work backwards. Was that 300-ish number over or under what your mental over-under line would have been?
If under.
If you could go back and think about naive Rebecca. Under, you would have thought about more. Yeah, okay. You would have expected more.
I think, when I saw the 300 number, the internal dialogue I had was like, that seems low to me, given what I think the size of Simon and Schuster is, and the ferocity of the conversation, which I agree, it should be a ferocious conversation. And I wondered about what outreach to get signatures on that looked like. Like, is it just touching base with the people internally that you are pretty sure agree with you, and there won't be any retribution for you introducing this to them?
That's what I was wondering.
Because
about
at
too.
Some point, those, like, the adjacent possible of those relationships does stop at some point where someone is like, ooh, you know, Susie in the office next to me seems like she would get it, but also maybe she's high enough up in management that it would be too big of a risk for her to be involved with this. And we don't know what other kinds of conversations happened internally coming down from leadership in Simon and Schuster, but I assume in a big company like that, in any industry, if you have sort of discontent within the ranks, you also probably have some leadership trying to control it inside and talking to other managers about if or how to be involved and if or how to respond. But I think if Simon and Schuster has as many employees as I think they do, and that 300-ish represents like 10% of people signing it, that seems low to me. But I would assume that many more people agree with it than felt that they could be, you know, actively participating.
Yeah, I think I agree with that too. And maybe they agree with the spirit of the, and maybe not the language specifically in here.
Sure.
We talked about there's some messaging and verbiage in there that even if you agree with, like, I don't want to be working for a publisher that publishes Mike Pence, maybe this particular articulation of that position is not what you're looking for.
Right.
And not conversely, but alongside of that, maybe if your middle management are up and you do feel they shouldn't be doing Mike Pence, you don't need to sign a thing because you can squawk about it internally. Right. Like, I'm not going to sign the thing online that's unsigned on a Google Doc, but I'm sure as heck going to show up at the town hall and talk to other people and let it be known that I don't think we should be doing this, or ask questions, or otherwise apply pressure as people have the capacity to do so. So I'm not sure where that's going to go. I think the other, look, this is a centipede situation. There's a lot of shoes to drop here. It's not just another shoe. Centipede situation is a good show title. But like, we got news that, you know, William Barr's book is maybe a Simon and Schuster going to be title /
imprint. Kellyanne
Conway. This is going to heat up, not cool down. And what the employees want to do next is going to be really interesting.
Well,
I'm not sure. Much else to say about it at this point?
One of the ways that it is heating up is that there now is a letter of intent from publishing professionals across the industry, signed at this moment by 635 people. More than that, because that count is as of the 21st of April. So I will refresh when we're done talking about this one. I don't need this window anymore. That says, you know, it's signed by authors and editors and audiobook narrators and professionals from all over the industry, doing what I was sort of wondering about last week, of like, will there be some sort of coalition across publishing houses to reach some agreement about not publishing these folks? And the framing of this is one that I think this letter is better written. The messaging here is a little more thoughtful and I think more likely to succeed. But they say, we all love book publishing, but we have to be honest. Our country is where it is in part because publishing has chased the money and notoriety of some pretty sketchy people and has granted those same people both the imprimatur of respectability and a lot of money through sweetheart book deals. As members of the writing and publishing community, we affirm that participation in the administration of Donald Trump must be considered a uniquely mitigating criterion for publishing houses when considering book deals. And then goes on a little bit later to say, Son of Sam laws exist to prevent criminals from benefiting financially from writing about their crimes. In that spirit, those who enabled, promulgated, and covered up crimes against the American people should not be enriched through the coffers of publishing. And that is a connection to an external principle and an existing precedent that I think is really powerful and very smart. And it's not tied to some slippery slope of somebody's judgment about who is or isn't a gross political person who has done bad things and shouldn't get a book deal. And to be clear, someone is still going to have to make those decisions. There are plenty of people in politics who have pushed forward policies that are incredibly harmful who did not work in the Trump administration. And there will continue to be. And a lot of those people could probably sell a lot of books. It's like somebody in publishing, editors and, you know, acquiring publishers are still going to have to make judgment calls. But this at least is saying, let's all just agree as a starting place not to give these sweetheart book deals to anybody from the Trump administration, because that administration committed crimes. Working in that administration was functionally being an accomplice, if not a person directly committing the crimes. And we can separate that from something else, from some other, just, you know, I don't know, Senator Kevin McCarthy, who's my favorite punching bag lately, from him getting a book deal, which would still be gross, but it's a meaningful difference of both kind and degree, I think. So I was really interested to see the letter writers here, and I don't know who drafted this letter, but to see whoever drafted this come to the place of, you know what, like, let's call them criminals, because many of them were and are, and let's rely on that existing rule that we have, you know. And I don't think they're asking for a law to be made that prevents a politician who did bad things from getting a book deal, but asking publishing to acknowledge what we're talking about here with children in cages, involuntary surgeries on captive women, the claiming that the coronavirus was a hoax and letting people die on your watch, and many, 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 many other things are criminal behaviors or acts of criminal negligence. And we don't want to give book deals to criminals. Seems like a pretty good place to start.
Yeah, I think where the Jonathan Karp letter seems to suggest that there maybe is a line, and, you know, we know it and we see it and we'll get there. This is suggesting that there is indeed a line, and it's one that we could maybe make a principle around. I think there's still plenty of room for this to be a really hard thing to enforce in a way that everyone's not going to feel good about. It. But let's say within the publishing industry, within a big publisher is going to feel good about, because someone who promulgated, like, okay, what does that mean exactly? Is it every member of the Trump administration? Because Anthony Fauci was right there. It's hard for me to say Anthony Fauci shouldn't get a book deal. So, like, all the things happen, yeah, like, but we're starting to move.
How do you define administration? Like, is working for the CDC during this presidency? Does that count? Yeah, that's a challenging question.
I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, well, because that's what, you know, that's maybe the exception that proves the rule. But, like, this idea of the Son of Sam law is interesting, of, like, prevent criminals from benefiting. So, okay, if you are convicted of a crime, on the other hand, publishing gives book deals to people all the time who've been convicted of crimes. We just saw the thing Cherry turned into a Netflix movie from jail, robbing banks.
Yep.
Not great, Bob. Not what you want. And that's okay. We don't have any, like, this feels like an external principle, but I think it introduces a different rather than better set of problems, because the idea is the same. Now, again, I'm not trying to forestall the conversation. I'm just saying this is the next step. I don't think this is the end of how you get to a place like this. I think this is something we've learned in business, that you can have all the principles you want. You can have all the guidelines you want. You can have all the process doc you want, but life, to quote Jeff Goldblum, finds a way to find the cracks and the edge cases and the gray areas. And just owning that is part of the process.
And,
you know?
And you always have to make judgment calls. I think maybe a first step version of publishing coming to some understanding of how to do this is something that Frankensteins together several things, like, okay, let's not give book deals to criminals. Let's look at folks high up in the Trump administration that we can tie to things we equate as crimes or things that are literally crimes.
Yes.
Not give them book deals, and then start to talk about the other principles we're going to hang our hats on when we have to make edge case decisions that call for that require a judgment call, because there will always be something that requires a judgment call. And that, I mean, the money, I'm all worked up, Jeff.
Yeah, it's fine. Hey, I'm right there with you.
The rubber hits the road there with being willing to give up some money.
That's right.
Your principle.
To not sign on the line, which is dotted
it
sometimes.
I heard somebody say recently, and it's a thing that I'm just going to keep coming back to, it's not your principle until it's cost you something. You don't have a principle until you have sacrificed something. in order to uphold that principle. And that's really where the Jonathan Karp approach fails for me. It's like the idea of a principle, the idea of values without actually sacrificing anything. We're going to keep publishing Mike Pence. Let's just remember that some of our books aren't harmful. You know, okay, well, you haven't given up anything.
Yeah.
And to transition just a little bit to the Blake Bailey stuff, and Ron mm-hmm. Charles's great column in the Washington Post this week talked about both the Blake Bailey situation and what's going on at Simon & Schuster. I think that publishing needs to reckon with the fact that I think they're overestimating the appeal of a lot of these books. Like, how much are you paying Kellyanne Conway, and how much are you paying Mike Pence, and how many real readers are going to buy those books? Because one thing we know is that the GOP has a large machine for right. doing bulk purchases that land titles like this on bestseller lists. But does the reading public really want these books? Are you really going to make meaningful money on them? And even if you are, I still don't think that's sufficient. But what's the opportunity cost? What voices mm-hmm. are you not putting out into the world? What new authors are you not bringing on that you could publish, you know, probably 20 debut novels for the cost of one Mike Pence memoir? Like, you're making choices about which voices to platform, and implicit in that is which voices are you not platforming. Mm-hmm. And some acknowledgement of that, and of the fact that if we stop rewarding folks who commit these kinds of behaviors and put the money somewhere else, that goes toward positive growth for the industry and for society, for our democracy. And if publishers are going to reckon with their businesses as not just neutral platforms, but as responsible for the consequences of the information that they put mm-hmm. out into the world, then what kind of world are you trying to make, and what kind of books go towards that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that point has been talked about more over the last week than certainly I thought about, and I think that we talked about it all, is like, there is the giving money piece, right? There's the have the name and the call fund. The other thing is how much attention it sucks up from your company, right? Because it's going to be a big deal. There's going to be a lot of effort. What could happen if that attention was placed elsewhere? And if it's the difference between Simon & Schuster staying in business or not, say that.
Mm-hmm.
Because at least we would know, right? At least, and I don't believe that.
Right.
They're going to be part of PRH. It's a big ship. Are they afraid from like a competitive point of view, like in The Godfather saying, the five families saying, we've got to get into drugs because if we don't, people are going to take our turf because that's the next thing, because they're going to have all the power, because they have all the money. So they're going to take the stuff we usually, the other less bad, but still really bad stuff we do, at least according to them.
Mm-hmm.
Are they worried that like, well, some conservative press is going to pop up and they're going to get all the dollars and we're going to lose our place as 75% of trade publishing as PRH, SNS. It's just not going to, going to happen.
I have questions about how these books keep landing at Simon & Schuster. Like, this seems to be an established pattern in the last couple of years, at least with Simon & Schuster, that started with the Milo book and then the Woody Allen situation and now this series of Trump administration.
Wasn't Woody Allen a shit? I mean, I keep getting that
I'm
wrong.
I'm pretty
it doesn't
sure
matter.
Woody,
it feels,
I'm,
I the, your larger point is right. Sorry,
yeah,
I shouldn't have
yeah.
prompted it there.
No, it's okay. I'm pretty Google. Sure Woody Allen was Simon & Schuster, but we can Google it later.
Yeah.
Is Simon & Schuster consistently outbidding everybody else, or is everybody else passing on these books, or is it some combination thereof? But how does this keep happening?
Yeah, look, what does Madeline McIntosh think about all this? Because this circus is coming to town and it's going to be in her yard, right? Like Madeline McIntosh, the CEO of Random House, Penguin Random House.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bertelsmann on top of that, right? Which is the parent company. There's turtles all the way up. As these
turtles all the way up. Woody Allen was Simon & Schuster.
Was Simon & Schuster. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I keep thinking it's a shit. Anyway, thank you for that, for correcting my erroneous correction.
Well, we know I like to confirm it when I'm right. So
yeah, that's the best time to confirm. So I think that's the piece that I've ultimately come back to for myself. You know, we talked a little bit last week. I said, you know, the thought experiment of if you had a chance to do it, even if you believed in, you know, this is a world historical document, which it will be, you know, whether you like it or not, it's going to be a world mm-hmm. historical document. Would the idea of seeing like I Did It My Way by Mike Pence or whatever it's going to be called with a book riot, or insert your company here that you work for Colophon?
Yeah.
What does that do to your gastrointestinal state? Mine decreases it meaningfully to think of it that way. This is also my personality. I'd rather make $1 I feel good about that two that I'm like, like that's just my personality. And I don't know that I know everyone doesn't feel like that. Is publishing thinking in those terms? Because my other little birdie stuff I heard this week, inclusion, diversity, it's been the talk. We've heard the talk, but these are people close to the metal, booking campaigns, thinking about campaigns, getting direct. Like I heard stuff from Big Five publishers saying, we want to be the most diverse publishing house in the industry. We're trying to get more ad dollars to places that are, you know, support inclusion of historically underrepresented voices, but also owned by them, operated by them, is thing that they're doing. They're looking at their budgets, they're looking at their authors, everything else. And I think that cognitive dissonance is part of it here, right? That's a meaningful part that's underlying, is that there's talk on one side about doing all these things, and the other side, doing my pens. Maybe people would still be as angry if we weren't having all this motivation wave reckoning on the other side of like, we're going to do better about this and also still put. Can you do both? That, I think that's the essential question that a lot of employees and you and I are kind of asking.
Yeah, I don't know if you can do both. I think it's very challenging, but I can also imagine a situation where if the workforce is actually more diverse, and employees feel that they're seeing meaningful work from these companies in that direction, and that builds trust. And if you trust that your company is trying to do these things, and then they come and say, all right, we have these values of diversity and inclusion, and we're a business that has to make money. A book by a vice president is newsworthy. It's part of the historical record.
It's going to sell for 100 years.
It's going to sell for 100 years. Here's how we think it's going to impact the bottom line this year. We know that not everyone will love it. We want to acknowledge that up front. Like, there are so many ways you can get out in front of this. And it doesn't ever make it feel good. Right. But if you believe that your employer is working hard and making a difference in many other vectors of that, it probably goes down a little bit easier. Not that, and I don't know that it has to go down easier, or that we want publishing to be.
Yeah, I guess that's the question. Like, do we want the suppository to be more comfortable, or do we like, hey, wait a minute?
Yeah, and if it's just the Mike Pence book, is that a different problem or a non-problem relative to that it's this pattern, especially that Simon and Schuster seems to have? How does that feel different? You know, one thing that Ron Charles hangs a nice lantern on is this is having this push-pull is a consequence in a good way. It's a feature, not a bug, of having a more diverse workforce. He says the real goal behind a diverse workforce is a wide range of experiences and ideas and people empowered to act on them. And that in the earlier times where everybody in the executive office was white and most of them were men, stuff like Blake Bailey gets pushed aside as locker room talk. And publishers were making their highly subjective judgments just based on what mostly white men
their own
valued.
Weltanschauung is
right,
their
right.
own their own yeah. sort of sense of how the world is put together.
Yeah, yeah. And there's the Ron Charles has a nice sentence here: for all Karp's high-minded allusions to appreciating the ideological spectrum, for many decades those judgments were based on what white men considered important, valid, and entertaining. And now that workforces are diversifying some, and folks just feel more empowered and able to speak up, they can organize with each other. We have the internet that lets us do these things, and they can speak back to their employers because the employer has said, like, if you roll out making a statement of Black Lives Matter and we want to be inclusive, and then your actions don't line up with that, your staff are teed up, and they should be teed up to hold you accountable for it and to push back. And that's what these folks are doing. Like, the fact that you have this dissent within your ranks at Simon & Schuster is a sign that something is going right.
Yeah, that's right. Or you misunderstood what having a more diverse workforce meant. Did you really think that just having a whole bunch of different people, different voices, meant you were going to do everything the same way?
Just a rainbow-colored group of yes
people.
How
was that going to work? How was that? Like, anyone who understands the kind of change that comes along with inclusion should know that the status quo is going to change. And in ways for people in power often aren't going to like, because you know why? They're already in power. Everything worked out great for them the way things were going. Of course it feels like it's something. You know why it feels like it? Because it is changing. And as you say, it's a feature, not a bug. And you know what? If some conservative publisher wants to be the sixth of the big five or whatever, and they take all these people and they make millions of dollars selling to zealots in convention centers when they go on tour or whatever, go and God bless. I'll compete them in ways you feel good about. Yep. I'll compete them in ways you feel good about. Let's take a sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hero to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hero's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode.
I've got a segment, a quick one.
Okay.
That I told you I was going to do, but I didn't tell you what we're going to do. For the first time in 6 years, I bought myself a new dedicated e-reading device.
You did?
A new Kindle, a refurbished Kindle Oasis.
Okay.
And I wanted to talk about it for a few minutes. I'm not sure if anyone's interested, but I've got feelings and thoughts about this.
I am so interested because historically you have been an iPad reader. Yes.
I know. This might be just for an audience of one because I thought you might like this because we've talked about I think still that probably the iPad Air is the best all-around reading device you can get. And I say that for a couple of reasons. One is, especially if you read a lot of comics, it's full color and it's the right size, right? It's, you know, it's the size of a comic book. The other virtue of an iPad, or I guess there's some other tablets like the Samsung Galaxy tablets. I throw them all in there. Like a small LCD tablet that can have arbitrary apps on it is good. You can pick your apps. I can pick my Apple Books rant I just went about. I can buy my book there and listen to it there if I want. But that's what my phone is. I mean, that's kind of what I'm – one of the things that's going on here is my phone is outsourcing a lot of my audiobooks and my Libby and all that kind of stuff. And what books am I actually reading digitally? I read prose. I don't do a lot of illustrations. I'm not doing cookbooks. I'm not doing comics anymore myself. My kids are doing – I'm reading Lumberjanes and print and stuff like that with my kids.
Lumberjanes with the kids.
I mean, what else do you want, right? So throw it out. Throw the iPad in the – but the thing is my iPad is big and it's heavy and it's reading season outside and it sucks to read outside. iPads suck to read outside, Rebecca, right? They just don't have the same thing.
They do. I'm a devoted iPad mini user.
Yep. It's also a great device.
It is.
All the same things I just said, right?
But if it's sunny and you want to be in the sun, you're boned for a reading experience.
You really are. You really are. It's not a great experience. And I'm reading so much. I've read a lot more recently, and I had an old Kindle that's dead. And I was like, you know, what do I really want here? The new Oasis, I got the Oasis One. It's a little bit bigger, and I'm 6'4", so I'm a big fella. You know, I'm just big. So, like, a bigger device in my hand is fine with me. I'd rather have the big one. In fact, I wish the Oasis was a little bit bigger. Even I'm just sort of like, this is kind of wee in its own way. But it's a good size. It's bigger than the Paperwhite. It has a backlight. You can also read it in direct sun. It also has this warming sort of, you can have a kind of a yellowish tint to the paper too, which is kind of different on the eyes. And also reading at night, I find that to be even better than reading on an iPad, which is frankly still looking at a computer screen. And I don't want that. I look at screens all day. I do, frankly, most of my digital reading, I buy deals from BookRite deals a lot. I do Libby, which I can send to Kindle, and I do Galleys, which I can get off Edelweiss, and it's a little bit of a hacky thing to get on my Kindle, but I can still do it. But you know what? For dedicated prose readers, a dedicated e-reading device is wonderful. Like, I ripped off 7 books in like 10 days, which is wild for me. And some of it, I was plowing through Shadow and Bone and catching up some stuff I was really looking forward to. So I had like the kindling was dry. You know, I was ready for the match.
The Kindle.
Yeah, I didn't even know I was doing that. It's a little expensive. I bought a refurb. I got the 8 gig with ads, so it's like kind of the cheapest one you can get. It's $209 is what it was. So that's a little pricey. But I gotta say, the only thing I really don't like about it is, again, I wish it was an 8-inch screen rather than a 7-inch screen. I think it would just handle my man hands a little bit better that way. But the other thing is, the regular Kindle has like kind of this nice rubbery soft touch thing, and this is aluminum backed, and it doesn't feel great. The edge is a little sharp. I looked at cases, and it's kind of a weird shape. I don't think that's gonna work. So I think I'm just going to get used to it. But
interesting.
It is also, it's a great device. Like, the Kindle Oasis is a great, great, great reading device. It's fast. It has 300 PPI, which is about double of what a normal Kindle does. So it's really high, sharp definition text. I'm out there in full sun. I can read. And my iPad I've had for a while, and so its battery life kind of is like, you know, this is what happens with mobile batteries. I don't know what to tell you, whether it's your phone or AirPods. Like, you do lithium ion charges over and over and over and over again every day. Yep. They wear down. The Kindle, I can charge in, and I don't have to worry about it for 2 weeks. Whereas iPad, I'm charging every night. If I forget to do it, I'm out of juice and blah, blah, blah. I'm trying to read outside, and I'm turning the screen all the way up to brightness to try to see anything, and that nukes the battery.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure where people are in this, but I kind of came back around to just having the – I can also fit it in, like, my jacket pocket, which is kind of nice. So if I'm walking outside, because I've got big 6'4"
I was just
clothes.
Thinking, imagine having jackets. Like, I'm, you know, what, 16 inches shorter than you?
right. Yeah, I know this thing is probably an iPad mini to people that are a little bit smaller, but I'm really liking it. Maybe it's just one of those, you know, romance of the new, and you know, you falling back into a habit, and I like the books, and I got sucked into them. I picked up Pachinko, which I never did. I never got around to that, and that's wonderful, as everyone said it was, by Min-Jin Lee, and just like stuff like that. So I'm not sure. I'd love to hear from listeners if they've abandon their e-readers, if they're doing e-reading, if they're doing on iPads like I've recommended over time. If I was doing big illustrated book cookbooks, if I was doing comics, photography, you know, nonfiction with a bunch of illustrations, the truth of the matter is I just don't do that as much anymore. Plus, I have an iPad, so I'm lucky that if I want to do something that needs an iPad, I can do that. So I can have two devices, but I think my iPad's going to go in the drawer for a while, because that's all I was using it for, is reading. Yeah, that's I use my iPad for.
I think that's where... Oh, that's where we differ in the use cases, is I use my iPad for reading, but then I also use it for like watching Netflix in the bath.
Yeah.
Or I take it when I travel, and then you can do all the things at one time, you know, watch a movie or read a book or check my flights or any of those things. Now that flights are like a thing in the world again.
Right. Right.
But if it were just about the e-reading experience, I would probably also lean towards a dedicated e-reader that was more flexible. Because what has shaken out in my reading life is I'm usually reading something on my iPad and something in print. And if I go outside, I just take whatever the thing in print is, which is fine. I'm very rarely like, oh, I want my iPad book, but I have to take my print book outside instead.
But it's I don't have print. It's just
additional layer of consideration.
So I'm not sure. That's super interesting. And the hardware hasn't changed for several years. The only thing I would really change about, honestly, again, it's hard to make devices that humans interact with that's good for all shapes and sizes, right? So I acknowledge I'm on the one end of the bell curve on this, you know, the hand feel. Like, I get the biggest phone I can get, right? Because it just feels, that feels better to me. But then I think the backing, but if it weren't for those two things, I'm not sure what I'm looking for. I'm not, I can see why they haven't changed the hardware that much, because it's kind of the end of the technological road when it comes to this.
Bob and I were talking recently about, he's been on a coffee journey the last several years, which I think you can probably relate to, where like the method of making his coffee got increasingly complicated for a couple years, and now it has contracted back to a very simple method. And he was like, you know, I liked the feeling fancy of making coffee in this complicated method, but I think I have come to the place of, all you're really trying to do is get hot water over ground up beans and transmit the flavor in a, like an efficient way where the water's still hot and you get what you're looking for. And it turns out that the simple method actually gives me the result that I desire at this point. And I think this happens, like, that if we were music wonks instead of book people, we would probably be like coming back around to, like, you know, well, I don't know that music has a similar, maybe.
Well, Neil Young released this high fidelity music player digital thing that's supposed to be way better than MP3s and all this kind of stuff. Like, and the giant headphones that you've got to plug into like a transformer, you know, like all that kind of stuff. And then you come around and it's like, you know, what am I actually trying to do here? I'm trying to get Paul Simon or Beyonce into my ears.
Right. And it turns out that doing that with Spotify and your AirPods is about as good as you need it to be. Like, maybe that you get a top 10% difference from doing the fancy thing, but there's extra work there too. And I think there's something to be said for that, of like boiling down to like, what am I really looking for from my reading experience, and getting that as directly as you possibly can.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, and I'm lucky that I can do both, right? That I've got the I've got my iPad and I've got the e-reader as well. But for those of you out there who are investing in your reading lives, I wonder if you've come around back at all, because it's been a while since I looked at it seriously. But I realized it's so nice here. I was like, I don't want to read outside with the iPad because I can't see the damn thing.
Yeah. What else did you burn through?
Pizza Girl. Did you read that? I can't remember the author's name. It came out last year. It's a novel. It's like if an indie movie were a book.
No, we could talk about that
some other time. Yeah, it was one of those PRH darling kind of critically acclaimed, and no one read it. but it was pretty good. I did all three Shadow and Bones. I did Uchinko. I caught up with God, there's something else. What was it? Oh, Gentleman Moscow. I'm halfway through right now. The Immortals. Because we were talking about, like, that's one people asked for recommended, and I haven't read that one before. I did Starless Sea, Aaron Morgenstern. The less said, the better.
Agreed.
Right, yeah, so that's another thing. And then up next is Leigh Bardugo for me, The Ninth House. And then I've got some galleys. I'm looking for The Other Black Girl. Is on my galley list.
Oh, that's on my galley list too.
So anyway, that's what's new from the world of books and reading on my side. We better do one more sponsor break, and then we'll get out of here.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
All right. We kind of mushed all these up. Did we want to say anything else about Charles's piece?
I think take some time to read it. You know,
it's in the show notes.
It's in the show notes. And to pick back up the thread from the top of the show, I think it is important and needs to be celebrated that functionally an old white guy of the publishing establishment is coming out using his giant platform to talk about these issues in a way that is affirming. But as you said, it's not like now they're valid because Ron Charles is in the conversation. These have been valid concerns all along. But a sad truth of living in a white supremacist patriarchal society is that for meaningful change to get pushed all the way up through the ranks, you have to get white men on board in making that change. And, or at least that's what has been historically true so far. And it matters that there are powerful white men willing to use their positions to support the work that's being done inside the ranks of publishing, that's being led by women and queer people and people of color, and say, like, let me listen to you and amplify this message. Because the folks who are reading Ron Charles on a daily basis, many of them probably need to hear that from someone who looks and feels familiar to them. And it's far too easy to dismiss an argument like this if it's, oh, that's the young people, or oh, that's the women again having these issues, or that's just the liberals. And for, you know, knowing what the readership, like the general demographic makeup of newspaper readership is, there are probably some older people or some more conservative people that are now going to be receptive to this argument in a new way because someone who they feel a little bit closer to or who they see as similar to themselves has made that argument in a way that they it's let those who have ears to listen hear, I think. And everyone needs to hear it from a different place. And that's something I've been thinking about a lot lately. There's a new episode of the Ezra Klein Show about, like, how do we get beyond just knee-jerk cancel culture? And he and his guests talk about the utilities of public accountability and some of the shaming that happens in cancel culture, and also the real limitations of that, in that sometimes it stops members of particular groups from having conversations with their people that can bring those people into a movement. You know, we need white men talking to other white men about why feminism is important and about why racism is a real thing. And we need conservative people who are starting to get it to talk to other conservative people about why queer issues matter and why trans people should have rights. And those conversations are messy, and people are going to make mistakes along the way. And if there can't be any discussion about it until everyone's vocabulary is perfect, we're not going to get anywhere. So I'm really just glad to see somebody take their platform and use it in this way, and hopefully reach an audience that isn't on Twitter, that's not signing petitions that make demands for change, but that can be open to understanding why this is important and can shift whatever power they have then, whether it's power as a consumer or power as someone who knows somebody or who just wants to be a person in the world thinking about where their book dollars go and how publishing might work. It really matters. Everybody who gets on board the train matters, regardless of, like, when you get on or where you get on or how much you have to left to learn.
Because
when you
the train start. Is made of people. People are the train. Like, we got it more on board. We need more people with bigger platforms, more voices, because then that starts to move the conversation from something that an executive or a board can think of as outside the mainstream, a fringe opinion, to now you are outside the mainstream. You are the one that you thought you were in the engine. Actually, you're falling off the caboose at this point. So get on board. Let's get out. You know, I saw something this week. This is more something I meant to put on our company Slack, but I'm bringing it here because I think it's interesting. We've wondered in other media worlds, like, what kinds of conversations like this is going on. And I was assuming it's happening. I know it's happening in, like, the movies and music world and other TV and other kinds of places. I know it's happening in architecture because I live with an architect. There's the kind of stuff going on here too. But Epicurious this week, did you see this story?
Oh yeah, Epicurious isn't going to do
they're
beef.
They're not going to do beef. No beef recipes because they think. And again, I think I understand. This is not my areas of expertise by any stretch of the imagination. But, like, basically, the agricultural practices around beef are super bad for the environment. Yeah. Like, you know what? We really can't. We don't feel good about participating in the industrial agricultural contract about beef specifically and what it takes to have a cow, make a cow, and, you know, all the water it takes in the land and blah blah blah. And it was like, that's their version of this.
Yeah,
that's their version of, we're not publishing Mike Pence. And you know what? I think they'll be fine. They have the same thing. That means that, I don't know, allrecipes.com, I don't even know what the big other platforms are. All the people looking for their beef recipes are going to go over there. We're going to lose that. But we're going to compete. We're going to live our morals, and we're going to see how we do.
Right. And I think Epicurious is not pulling all their old recipes that include beef. Like, the world doesn't need any new beef recipes. So Epicurious is going to be fine, and so is everybody else.
Right.
And I think Epicurious could pull all their beef recipes and still be just fine from the huge variety of other recipes mm-hmm. that you can find there. But yeah, that was really interesting to see as an example of a completely different industry making a judgment call about what their values are and right. what structures they're willing to support or not be a mm-hmm. part of.
Yeah. All right. Got to get out of here. Podcast at bookriot.com for feedback. Bookriot.com/listen for show notes. Rebecca, we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, actually, we'll be back on Monday or on Wednesday as you're listening to this with Moms, Dads, and Grads.
Right.
Bonus episode season is coming.
We're recording and releasing next week. Yeah, so next time you hear from us, we will not be talking about Gilead or Night Circus or Little Fires Everywhere or you know, some of
it'll be fun. It's a good list this time.
All right. As always, thank you, Rebecca.